Good morning. This is Focus 580. It's our morning telephone talk program. My name is Jack Brighton. Glad you could listen today. Americans have always been ambivalent about the morality of wealth and poverty. The American ideology of independence has often collided with the reality of interdependence, to the point where cause and effect become blurred. A gifted entrepreneur becomes wealthy through their own insight and hard work, while another fails and becomes destitute, or one person born amid generations of poverty somehow climbs the economic ladder, while another becomes a homeless drug addict. Did justice or some kind of natural law determine that one will succeed while the other one fails? Can we reasonably say that each person is responsible for their own fate and only for their own fate? Or is our economy and its moral implications a bit more complicated than that? At the end of the Cold War and at a time when politicians of both major parties declare that public welfare entitlements are coming to an end, it may seem that this question has been answered in the negative. But history and historical debates have a way of coming back. During this hour of Focus 580, we will look back at some of the debates over money and morals in American history. Our guest is historian and author Patricia O'Toole. She has written more than 250 articles, essays, and reviews on business, social, and cultural issues for such publications as The New York Times, Smithsonian, and Civilization, and was the author of a critically acclaimed book recently, The Five of Hearts, An Intimate Portrait of Henry Adams and His Friends. And during this hour of Focus 580, we'll talk with Patricia O'Toole about her newest book, Money and Morals in America, A History, recently published by Clarkson Potter Publishers. In the book, Ms. O'Toole focuses on 13 individuals or groups of individuals who in some way laid the groundwork for our present understandings and conflicts over money and its role in the American enterprise, ranging from John Winthrop and the Puritans of Massachusetts, Benjamin Franklin and the Founding Fathers, the disaster of American slavery, Henry Ford's $5 workday, the Tennessee agrarians, the civil rights movement, all the way to latter-day social innovators such as William Norris and the Interfaith Center on Corporate Responsibility. We'll tackle at least some of that and hopefully get to some of the most important points in her book during this hour. As we talk with Patricia O'Toole, you are invited into the conversation. Questions and comments on the topic are welcome. You can call us around Champaign-Urbana at 333-9455 or toll-free anywhere you hear us around Illinois and Indiana, 800-222-9455. Again, around Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL, toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-WILL. Patricia O'Toole, good morning.
Hi, Jack. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Pretty good, thanks.
Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
I think, first of all, your book is a collection of great stories, and those stories show that we've always had differing visions of what money is and what an economy should do for the people living in it.
That's right. From the very beginning, well, actually, American history has so many beginnings, it's hard to know where to start. I started with John Winthrop and the Puritans, who came in 1630, and they had this amazingly idealistic notion that they could found a society upon Christ's words that we should all love one another. And as far as I can tell from my reading of colonial records, they were successful in this for about 2 weeks. And then the free-for-all began, and we've been arguing about it ever since.
Yeah. Well, the notion that, we should take care of each other and not just ourselves certainly sounds like, the better angels of our nature. Unfortunately, when we find ourselves in very difficult circumstances, as the early Puritans did, maybe the lesser angels kind of take, priority.
Well, those angels are always struggling. That's what got me interested in writing this book, because it seemed to me when I went back and started rereading American history from the beginning that there are two sets of possibilities, and they're both important to us as Americans. One is this idea that we could create a more ideal society, something better than had been created in other places in the world, because we were starting fresh. So what we could think about what we wanted it to be rather than how to deal with what was already there. So we've had these very high aspirations from the beginning, and we still have them, I think. And the other thing, this great tabula rasa that the Europeans came to, this incredibly rich country, rich in natural resources, rich in space, fueled all kinds of dreams of materialistic gain. And it's not that other cultures don't have those same dreams, but we've probably had more opportunities than most other places in the world to make those dreams come true. So this opportunity for individual gain and this aspiration for a really fine concept of the public good, where we are connected to each other, those things we've always both wanted and both struggled to have throughout our history, I think.
Well, maybe we could talk about some of the details of that story, because I think it's very interesting. They came, you know, the early Puritans to Massachusetts, and they had a particular vision, or at least John Winthrop did, certainly. And that vision included some detail about how they were going to relate to each other and what their obligations were, and to love one another and so forth. Can you talk about the way that reality sort of impinged upon that dream?
Well, sure. In the beginning, John Winthrop, when they were on the boat sailing over here, he set up this notion that they would be a city upon a hill. And by that he meant that the whole rest of the world would be watching to see how they did. And he thought that just made them have to succeed, to have a godly kingdom in this new world, because otherwise nothing would change. The world would go on just as it was. And the Puritans, incidentally, what it was they wanted to purify, I mean, Puritan has come to have many different overtones over the years, but what they originally wanted to purify is they were upset about the sort of high church Anglican practices in churches in England. So they were just trying to purify church services in the beginning, and when they couldn't achieve that in England, they said, well, let's leave and start over, and while we're at it, we'll create this really ideal society. But the way that reality impinged on that was really through the mere fact of wilderness. You have all these people turning up. They all need some place to live. They have a chronic shortage of labor and a chronic shortage of materials. So what typically happens in any situation like that is whoever can bid the highest for labor and materials gets his house built first and tends to have the advantage. So what they were doing early on to try to prevent the more affluent members of the community from sort of sucking up all the resources was they instituted a series of wage and price controls to just kind of keep a lid on all these economic problems that arose out of the condition of wilderness. And then the other thing that happened, Winthrop had this notion that everybody should live close together, that's how you had a community. And that was a little too tight for some people. I mean, the urge to privacy asserted itself very early on. People were always dreaming of, oh, if I could just move around the next bend in the river where these people weren't looking at everything I do all the time. And so that desire for privacy and the possibility of having it just because the country was so big and so empty, that's where all of that gets rooted in American culture too. And that notion of privacy, I think we have carried it leads to the individualistic rhetoric that we have in our culture about sort of every man for himself, and I pulled myself up by my bootstraps, why can't you do the same thing? And it's that what happened in the Puritan days with this, I think, really sowed the seeds of our impulse away from community.
Yeah. Well, the colony did eventually survive and succeed to some extent, but not on the terms that they had originally thought they would.
Right. It got vastly more democratic, yeah, for one thing. In the beginning, Winthrop had all the power, and over time, people just insisted that not be the case, so he had to surrender bit by bit his czar-like authority. And also, they worked very hard, and as a result of their hard work, and also as a result of continuing waves of settlers coming to Massachusetts, they prospered, and that just gave them a more secular vision of the world. They had God was still in the center of things for them, but they were making other considerations as well.
And the commandment to love one another was not essentially the basis of that social contract.
No, it still got preached in the churches for a very long time, and what it did create was kind of anxiety about greed, and I think we still feel that. That's our kind of economic legacy from the Puritans, that too much greed makes us nervous. And also they were, in their way, they did care about the poor, but they're the ones who came up with this concept of the worthy poor. In other words, we're willing to help widows and orphans, but if somebody isn't going to work hard, boy, that was a really big sin in Puritan times, and we still feel that way.
The second chapter, to me, is among the most interesting in the book, although there are others, certainly, I find really intriguing. And it tells the story of James Oglethorpe and the founding of the colony in Georgia. And I think, one of the most interesting facets of this story is that Oglethorpe and colleagues came to the New World in 1729 or thereabouts.
1732.
It seems to me a very thoroughly thought out notion of what they were going to do about the inequities of wealth in society and how one would deal with poverty and the poor and what sorts of arrangements would lead toward a better scenario for a group of people who included both wealthy and poor.
Yes, this experiment that they conducted looked so great on paper. I mean, it's really amazing. They raised money for it. They wrote kind of a prospectus of what they were trying to do so that they could raise money for this. And boy, it's I think if I had been around, I would have given money to this because it seemed like such a great idea. England in the late, in the 1720s and 1730s had, there was the beginning of the, of manufacturing, and so there was, all of a sudden these merchant houses have been around for a while, so you're getting fortunes created in England from trade and a little bit from manufacturing, and there's a lot of new wealth, but it isn't trickling down to the bottom, and there are all these people ending up in debtors' prisons on account of this. So James Oglethorpe had this idea that the prisons were overcrowded and the conditions were terrible, which was absolutely true, and that really it was ridiculous to keep people in prison just because they hadn't been able to pay their debts. They'd, in effect, fallen way behind on their MasterCard. So England could grow rich by sending her poor abroad. That was kind of the sales pitch. In other words, we're not just going to turn these people loose onto the streets of London where, you know, the only improvement in their life is that they won't be in prison anymore. They're still going to be poor, so that probably means they're going to end up back on public assistance or back in prison. So we'll export them, send them over to Georgia, and we'll support them for a year, and we'll give them a certain amount of property so that they're going to have this new life in paradise. And, I mean, there's just nothing wrong with this plan on paper. But they get over there, and they take these people, and they decide that while they're giving them this new start in life, they're going to reform them. So they decided, for example, that they couldn't have rum in this colony. And the first community they settled was Savannah, which is right across the river from South Carolina, where they could have rum. So the first business that was really thriving in the colony of Georgia was bootlegging from South Carolina. These people had very little money, and it all just sort of floated up to the bootleggers in South Carolina. They also decided that they didn't want to have slavery in Georgia, and this was partly for humanitarian reasons, but it was also because they thought that if slaves greatly outnumbered the white settlers, the Spanish who were in Florida might be able to incite those slaves to rebel, and there would be massacres, and then Spain would be able to take over the colony of Georgia, which was territory that the English were claiming by by settling it with Oglethorpe. The other thing they decided that the settlers couldn't do was there were a lot of restrictions on the ownership of land. So you couldn't mortgage your land, for example, to expand, and you couldn't buy more than a certain amount of land because they thought people should live fairly close together in order to defend themselves from Spanish attacks, and they also imagined that there might be attacks by native tribes and that sort of thing. So they just imposed all these restrictions on the settlers, and the net effect of it was that there was very little room for self-interest. They got the idealistic part of it very well thought out, but they expected these human beings to be really better and more self-sacrificing than we know most human beings are capable of being. And the other thing that kind of sabotaged this experiment is that the land was not all it was cracked up to be. Someone, a Scottish explorer, had been to Georgia, and he had talked about it as the most amiable country in the universe, and he thought they'd be able to have wine, and he sent home reports of 7-inch ears of wheat and fruit growing all over the place, and a lot of the soil was sandy and a lot of it was swampy, and so they just weren't able to make very much progress with agriculture. And they put great hopes on having a silk industry there because there were a lot of mulberry trees said to be in Georgia.
Right.
And this was a total fiasco as well. It just didn't work out.
It almost seemed, you know, reading the chapter on Benjamin Franklin, that if the colony in Savannah had been composed of people like Benjamin Franklin, perhaps it would have succeeded. Unfortunately, he's a pretty rare character in history.
Yes, he was. He's my idea of the person who got this balance right between the pursuit of private gain and the taking care of the public good. He started out in life as a very ambitious young man, and we still know him for his sayings like "a penny saved is a penny earned." I mean, we all associate Benjamin Franklin with thrift and prudence about financial matters. And he worked pretty hard, had a very successful printing business in Philadelphia, and he gave it all up in about 1748. He was 42 at the time, and he's more or less retiring to devote himself to public service. And then he does this in a really interesting way. I mean, I think this is a pattern that other citizen activists have followed. He got involved in local affairs first, and then that led him to get involved in affairs of the colony of Pennsylvania, and then before you know it, he was involved in affairs that had to do with all the colonies, and a leader in the American Revolution, and in the key figure in the writing of the Constitution as well. Actually, he's a very old man at that point, but he did take part in the Constitutional Convention in 1787. So he retires at age 42, and then he lived another 42 years, and he devoted it all to public service, and that's an ideal that we've heard of since. It expresses itself in a man like Theodore Roosevelt, for example, who came from a family that had a lot of money, and what he wanted to do with his life is devoted to public service. And then one of Theodore Roosevelt's sons, Theodore Jr., did kind of the same thing. He made a lot of money when he was a very young man and then devoted himself to public service. So it's a kind of model, upper-class model for contributing to society that I think we owe pretty much to the example of Benjamin Franklin. He's an interesting character in another way, in that he doesn't get associated with terms like liberal or conservative. Both sides seem to want to claim him as their own.
Let me just take a moment to reintroduce our guest this morning is Patricia O'Toole. She's the author of numerous articles and books on business, culture, history, including the book we're discussing.
their own version of the browser, which they nicknamed Mozilla. At the same time, throughout 1994, the university was hearing more and more about how Jim Clark had started up this new company and felt like there might be potentially a copyright infringement there, or they didn't like the fact that Clark was calling his company Mosaic Communications because their university product was called the Mosaic Browser. And there was a lot of tension back and forth, threats of legal action. And in the fall of 1994, Clark paid a settlement to the university and changed the name of his company to Netscape, and changed the name of the browser to Netscape Communicator.
We'll get into some more of those details in a minute. I do have another caller I want to include before we go too much further. Let's talk with a listener in Champaign on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yeah, it has to do with kind of what that tension that you had mentioned that was developing later and was talked about in the article that you mentioned in GQ. If you could talk a little bit more about some of the romantic notions that article in the magazine dispelled about how Mr. Andreessen wasn't even that good of a programmer and was, as the article portrayed him, at best an opportunist and who just recognized the potential. And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
I don't think I didn't think that article was particularly good. I mean, it set up a number of straw men that it proceeded to knock down. For one thing, the article said that it was commonly believed in the press that Mark Andreessen invented the browser. No one ever said that. Most of the articles that you read were careful not to ever say that. What Andreessen and Vina did was they created the first useful browser, the first browser that allowed you to view images in line with text and do all sorts of really great things. I don't know.
The article talked about, I guess the article claimed that, your words were that Andreessen was really an opportunist. I don't think that Andreessen ever portrayed himself as a brilliant programmer. I think that he always gave the credit for the programming genius to Eric Bina, and that Andreessen's gift was entrepreneurial. He was at heart a businessman who understood how to code and who understood software and who understood at a remarkably young age the mass market appeal of a product like this.
But even Andreessen's critics who work with him, programmers who are really talented, the ones that I've spoken to, they might say things about, you know, his personality, but even they say that he is a good programmer. He's not a schlub. I mean, Bill Gates takes a rap for not being a good programmer because programming became far more sophisticated after he came along. I don't believe that's the case with Andreessen. I think Andreessen is a very competent programmer.
And on the original Mosaic code, Andreessen coded the graphical user interface, the front end of the browser, which would be the portion that a user would see on his or her screen, and also worked on the network library, where Andreessen has always been very upfront about saying, kind of created the guts of the program.
Pied by Indians, considered essentially a blank slate by the Europeans coming in. And, you know, in addition to the resources being available, there was the Industrial Revolution and new technologies and a variety of new scenarios for humans to live in, you know, urban areas and the development of industry. And I think it's really interesting to note the experimentary nature of the early textile mills that you write about in Massachusetts, and how those were, you know, they were, the idea was almost a utopia to begin with, and it led very well, maybe not very quickly, but ultimately to a thoroughly established class system that was contrary to the very notions that it seems it was founded with.
I don't know that it was contrary to the notions that it was founded with, because the founders were upper-class Bostonians, and they never really imagined that the people they would employ in the factories would, you know, that their worlds would really come together and they'd all live together in some kind of democratic harmony. But they certainly were idealistic about what they were doing. Francis Cabot Lowell was one of the principal founders, and he was quite a good amateur mathematician and engineer, and he went over to Scotland in the early 1800s and visited a lot of textile mills, and we would go home after these visits and write down absolutely everything that he saw. In effect, he's committing industrial espionage here, and he brings all this information home to the best mechanic that he can find, and they get a very modern factory going in Massachusetts that then leads to other factories in Lowell, Massachusetts. If any of your listeners get up to the Boston area, a lot of this can still be visited. In the town of Lowell, there is a national park, more or less. It's not a typical national park with a fence around it and a gate that you drive in, but the National Park Service operates a number of buildings in Lowell that date back to this period, including one of the biggest cotton mills that was in operation then. So you can tour these buildings and see what the conditions were like. The noise is unbelievable. It's like standing on a runway at O'Hare. It's just, you can't imagine working with that day after day after day, and it's not just something you hear in your ears. You feel it all through your body. It's quite something. So they were again, starting tabula rasa. It seems we get to do that over and over in American history. And thinking, all right, well, we've seen these terrible factory conditions in Scotland and northern England. Let's do a really fine version of this. Let's build boarding houses for these young women to live in. They wanted young women to work in the plants because there was a shortage of male labor on the farms, and so they thought they wouldn't be able to kind of sell this idea to New England unless they were promising not to draw away the male labor force from the farms. And also the work was structured in a way so that most of it was light enough so that it could be done by women. So they're thinking that these girls would come from the farms and work at these factories for maybe 2 or 3 years and then go home and get married. And so they set this all up in a kind of boarding house way, and they would find these middle-aged Christian women to run the boarding houses, and that way it was thought that the fathers on these farms where the girls came from would feel all right about sending their daughters there to do this work. It wouldn't be like going off to terrible factory towns in England, which were thought to be filled with vices of every sort. So that was the picture in the beginning, and it really did seem to be that way in the beginning. Worked out for several years that it was a pretty good deal for everybody around.
And they provided education and all kinds of, yeah.
That's right, education, and they had their own magazine, and the girls were contributing to the magazine. They called themselves girls, by the way, in case anybody out there is wondering why I'm not saying women, but they called themselves factory girls. And then what happened is we got a little patch of hard times later in the 1830s, and so they started doing things like lengthening the hours that the girls worked and speeding up the machinery and trying to cut the pay. And their thinking about this was it would be better. I mean, we've heard versions of this since in downsizing and in the recession that was such a hollowing out recession in the early 80s in the Midwest. You would every once in a while read about, well, we can keep the plant open if everybody will agree to take a 10% pay cut, or the alternative is that we have to let X many people go. So this was the kind of thinking that was going on there. Some of that was, and you know, they would also cut dividends, but, you know, the labor very quickly saw that the people who actually owned these plants were not being asked to make sacrifices as great as the people who were actually working in them. But the pickle that these industrialists found themselves in, which is still something that business has to wrestle with today is, okay, we have this great plant, you know, this huge multi-million dollar investment. It's only a good thing if it's working. It's not a good thing if it's standing there idle. So there was this, all the thinking was oriented to how do we keep the machinery going. And Lowell lasted well into the 20th century. I think it finally, the last of the textile stuff kind of petered out in the 1960s, but by about the 1920s, a lot of it had headed to the South where labor costs were cheaper.
Mm-hmm. We also see in the Lowell textile plants some of the early union movement coming into place.
Right. All over New England where there were factories of various sorts, textile mills and mills that made shoes and other things. This was where the union movement began. And their first quest sounds horrible to us now, but what they were trying to do was get the Massachusetts legislature to agree to a 10-hour day.
Right.
And we're still talking 6 days of work, a week of, right. of work. So,
and the Massachusetts
legislature since then.
Yeah, and they did not succeed in that because,
no.
Yeah.
Took a long time, and the argument that one of the arguments that the legislature used was, well, if we do that, then all these mills will just move to New Hampshire or Rhode Island or whatever.
It sounds familiar also.
Yeah, sounds familiar. We still have this going on, as sort of a, I look at it as kind of a big game of chicken where states are trying to attract industries to come, and so then the company is in the position of being able to play one state off against another state and get itself the very best deal that it can. You know, most famously with Mercedes going to Alabama. It'll be interesting to see whether Alabama ever gets its money back on that one.
One of the interesting features of this story is the reaction on the part of people like Mr. Lowell to the feelings of workers that they were being exploited and underpaid. I mean, it almost seems like he felt betrayed.
Yes, they did, because it's an interesting lesson in how point of view is everything, because the point of view of the industrialists was, look, we have created something that is so much better than what your counterparts in England have to deal with when they go to work in textile mills. Why don't you appreciate it? But the people who were actually doing the work every day were saying, this isn't heaven. We don't know if it's hell, but it's sure some kind of purgatory that we have to be working with these speeded up machines and be working longer hours for less money, and they're raising the rates in the boarding house, and we can't go live someplace else. We have to be in these boarding houses, so it's all in how you look at it.
Yeah. Well, they also were aware that the corporation was paying pretty high dividends to its investors at the same time they were asking the workers to take a pay cut and to pay more for their boarding.
That's right. The if you look at the dividend payouts for the companies who were in Lowell during this period, they do fluctuate somewhat. But in good years, I mean, they were very high rates of return, like 20%, which is pretty incredible. And there were lots of people who were in that business who made a lot of money. They would know that bad times were coming, or, you know, because they were in the business, they would see the slowdown before the rest of the world saw it. So they would sell their stock, and then, you know, 2 years later when the business, when the economy turned around a little bit, they'd go back in and buy some more stock at a lower price. And there was one man who fancied that he had made $2 million just doing that, just speculating in textile stocks.
Well, the other, I mean, you quote someone, and I forget who it was in this scenario, who was saying, you know, I got wealthy almost by accident.
Yes, yes, that's right.
Yeah, and it seems, that seems an interesting counterpoint to the notion that, you know, this notion that we have still, that those who are wealthy must have earned it, they must have worked for it.
Well, there's an interesting aspect to all of that right now, I think, because We've had the stock market is taking its lumps right now, but if you look back to, say, July and the 2.5 years that preceded that, we've had this tremendous run-up. So what that has basically meant is that anybody who had any wealth at the beginning of that has a whole lot more now than they did 3.5 years ago. And the trouble with that is, and you can say, well, everyone can play that game, but the trouble with this is that poor people don't have any wealth. They have income if they're lucky. So this is a major contributor to the widening gulf we have between the haves and the have-nots, where between back in 1976, the richest 1% of the population owned something like 20% of the privately held wealth in this country. By 1996, which is pretty much before this big run-up, or kind of in the middle of the big run-up, we went from 20% to 40%, so great concentration of wealth at the top. And people who just have income, which would be all these laborers in the same position these laborers back in these 19th century factories would have been in, they just don't participate in the gains that go to people who have wealth in addition to income.
There are a number of other interesting stories that, hopefully we'll have time to talk about. You know, but there's an issue, there's a thread that runs throughout this, or several threads certainly. You know, you're talking about morality and wealth and poverty, and that is the differing views we've had of the deservedness of wealth and poverty, mm-hmm. and the prescriptions we've had for the poor. And that is that, you know, in many cases, there have been those who have said, well, you know, the poor may be not that way because of their own moral failings, but there seems to be a strong current throughout our history that does blame the poor and says it's because, well, if they were meant to be wealthy, and it's almost a social Darwinistic viewpoint, if they were meant to be wealthy, they would be. And, you know, if they were good enough, then they wouldn't be in the situation that they're in. And almost a paternalistic view that, well, they shouldn't be given more. They shouldn't be paid over X amount, because if we give them more money, they'll just waste it on, you know, self-destructive activities.
Right. That was pretty much Andrew Carnegie's point of view. He had a Darwinistic notion of things, and sort of the possession of great wealth, in his view, just verified that he was a superior human. Otherwise, he would not have accumulated this great fortune. And truly, he was a superior human. He was a man of extraordinary talent and vision. But he couldn't understand why, you know, he saw labor as a commodity like anything else. So for his steel mills, he'd be thinking, well, I have to get iron ore at the lowest possible price, and I have to get limestone at the lowest possible price, and I got to keep my shipping costs down as far as I can keep them down, and my labor costs. So he wouldn't, you know, he wouldn't look at it the way Henry Ford ended up looking at it in 1914, when he effectively doubled the average factory wage with the $5 day. Ford did that because he thought that workers really added value to the process, that they were not just another commodity, that he owed his fortune to not just to his own ingenuity, but to the labor of his workers. So you just have different points of view about those things. But carrying this forward to right now, I think we have a really serious problem, setting aside the whole question of the concentration of wealth that we were just talking mm-hmm. about. Mm-hmm. People at the bottom really need more money than they're getting. I mean, there's been some talk recently about gains in the lowest 20% of the population, where they're on paper somewhat better off than they were a couple of years ago, and a lot of this is attributed to the fact that many more of them have been able to find jobs because of this economic boom, and also the minimum wage has gone up 21% to $5.15 an hour. But back in the days when they invented the minimum wage, the idea was to have it be about half the average wage. And right now, the average wage is something like $12.70 an hour. So at $5.15 an hour, that's like 20% short of the target. And yet, every time there's a debate about raising the minimum wage, people scream and holler and say it's going to wreck everything, and we can't do it. And the net result of this low minimum wage is that right now, a family where there's a full-time worker who earns minimum wage, and that worker is trying to support a household that has three people in it, that family is living 18% below the poverty line. And 30 years ago, that same family would have been 11% above the poverty line. So there's just it's sort of, no matter how you feel about whether the poor are deserving or undeserving, it's just clear to me that people at the bottom need to be paid more money. I mean, that's why they're poor. They don't have any money. So those who are, and this is just talking about those who are working, so it doesn't involve those who don't want to work or can't work for some reason.
We have about 10 minutes left with our guest, Patricia O'Toole, talking about her book, Money and Morals in America, A History. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 333-9455. That's around Champaign-Urbana. Elsewhere, 800-222-9455. The other, well, many issues with regard to poverty in America, but it seems that we've had this long-running debate and have never been able to resolve. Those of us who are not poor anyway, in looking at people who live in poverty, whether you know, it's their fault or the circumstances they're in or some combination of the two. And our public policy has vacillated between the sense of community, and we all have an obligation toward each other, and this other American ideal, which is the individual is responsible for their own fate. And, you know, that's all they're responsible for. And I'm not sure where this debate leads us, if not into further argument. But one thing that I find throughout your book are people who were willing to think about it and to experiment with different possibilities. Henry Ford with his $5 day. There are some other characters who thought that maybe, you know, we could do something about this rather than just simply arguing. And those sorts of experiments might have been easier at a time when there was, you know, for example, states the size of Georgia that were relatively unoccupied except for the indigenous population. But in this day and age, those sorts of experiments, if they're imagined, what opportunities are there for them to be pursued?
Well, in some ways, I would think we have more opportunities now than we've ever had because you know, we've made such great progress in paying down the national debt, and we have so much affluence as a result of this great run-up in the stock market and also the boom in the economy and the great gains in productivity that we've seen through technology. So I think this would be a wonderful time for us to, all over the country, be having conversations about what kind of a society do we want to be. We all know the phrase, the common good, but I don't think any of us really know what that means anymore. I think it would be great if we could figure out what we want the common good to be and then set ourselves the goal of making sure that it's common to all, you know, that it's not contingent on how you behave, and think about this particularly in connection with children. Despite this big, long economic boom, we still have about 20% of American children living in poverty, and the only thing that's changed between 1989 and now on that is that there are 2 million more of them than there were. That's 14.5 million kids. I mean, it's a number that's so big, I think it implicates all of us and ought to goad all of us into trying to make sure that, you know, whatever we do or don't want to give to grown-ups whose behavior we don't approve of, we should be making sure that those children have everything they need so that they can have a different kind of life. And by everything they need, I'm thinking of health care and first-rate public schools. Businesses lobby for everything they want and feel they need. If I were a CEO, I'd probably be doing my share of that, too. I think it would be great if they would lobby for really good public schools, because it's clearly something that will benefit not just society in general or some abstract, mushy notion of a social good, but here we are moving into a world where there's no place for unskilled workers anymore, and it seems to me if you want to continue to be able to hire skilled, productive workers, a great investment to make is in great public schools.
There is a great story in your book about someone who did that. I'm thinking of William Norris of Control Data Corporation, who took it upon himself to essentially establish a facility in an inner city neighborhood that had been devastated by, you know, deindustrialization, and had some success. I wonder if you could talk about that particular story a bit, and maybe what it might show about the possibilities.
Well, back in the 60s, when there were a lot of riots in American cities, he very quickly, watching this on TV and reading about it in the newspapers, thought to himself, you can't do business in a society that's burning. So he thought, well, what can I do? What can Control Data do? And they built a number of factories in impoverished neighborhoods, some in inner cities, in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area, and Washington, D.C., and also in a couple of rural communities, one in Appalachia in particular. And they discovered when they brought to work all these people who either had not been working or who had been employed sporadically and at not very skilled labor before, that these people brought all kinds of problems to work with them, and that it wasn't just a worker who turned up at the door every day, that, you know, it was a human being with an entire life and often a very complicated life. You know, when an upper middle class business executive goes off to work during the day, very often his wife is home with the children or there's a nanny home with the children, but if you're really poor, you don't have supports like that, and you can't afford them. So daycare became a part of this. They started on-the-job counseling that later evolved into the whole notion of employee assistance programs, which are now a common feature of corporations all over the country. And they employee assistance programs help not just people who are at the bottom of the socioeconomic ladder, but people anywhere in the corporation who might have troubles in their families with substance abuse or might need help of various sorts to get them through a human crisis. And these workers, I mean, it did take longer to get them to be as productive as workers in other plants, but by George, they got there. And I think that demonstrates that we can do it. It just takes a whole lot of commitment. And the investment, every time people analyze it, it works out that it's worth spending the money that way, because if you're not spending it that way, it gets spent somewhere else in the social system in terms of funding welfare and people who are unemployed and people who get caught up in the justice system because they're robbing gas stations or whatever. Mm-hmm. So I frankly don't know why we don't, now that we are so rich, have more of those kinds of conversations.
We have just maybe 2 or 3 minutes left and a couple of callers. I want to make sure to include at least one, and so let's do that. That's a listener in Chicago on line number 4. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Good morning. I want to say how deeply I appreciate both the content and the tone of this discussion.
Thank you.
It occurs to me that what you're discussing here has a lot in common with the broadcast actually previous to this one, in as much as what so many people seem to be missing is that each of us, as individuals or as little interest groups or whatever it may be, are in a continuous process of creating one another, that we create our environment, whether that's the human beings around us in a different class or, you know, we're not very far removed from everyone else on this planet in terms of stages of interaction, and that we're what we create then is simultaneously creating us. You know, whether it's the natural environment, whether it's the human environment, and this just seems to be Greek to most people somehow. But anyway, I also wanted to question very quickly. You said earlier that your priorities, if I'm not mistaken, for children would be along the lines of education and what was the other?
Healthcare.
Healthcare, yes.
I have to ask you to hurry because we had about 30 seconds. I'm sorry.
I'm basically finished, and it just occurred to me, it does continuously, that that food and shelter are prerequisites for you know, for education and health. Education and healthcare are relatively superfluous, you know, compared to decent shelter and good food.
Well, yes, I'm right with you, and I'd start with prenatal care. You know, it all starts right there, and then you do need to make sure that nutrition is a part of it, and that people have a safe and decent place to live. But going back to your other point, you know, it's kind of interesting to think about, why do people need to tell themselves stories about the evils of the poor? You know, why do we need to explain poverty to ourselves in that way and detach those people from ourselves? Because your point about how we're not all that fundamentally different from each other is the basic one. The chain is only as strong as its weakest link. You know, so you have to be able to see your connectedness to all these people and understand that, I think.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there since we're here at the end of the time. As usual, we've kind of scratched the surface of the topic. There's much more in the book, and if those of you listening would like to take a look at it, the title is Money and Morals in America, A History. The author is Patricia O'Toole, who has been our guest. It's published by Potter Publishing. And to you, Ms. O'Toole, thank you very much for talking with us. It's been very interesting.
Jack, thanks so much to you. Had a wonderful time.